I found a family that has its meals in this hotel quite interesting. The father is a tall, thin man, always dressed in black and wearing a starched collar. The top of his head is bald, with two tufts of gray hair on each side. His small, beady eyes, narrow nose, and hard, straight mouth make him look like a well-brought-up owl. He's always first at the door of the restaurant, stands aside to let his wife, a tiny woman like a black mouse, go in, and then comes in himself with a small boy and girl dressed like performing poodles at his heels. When they're at the table, he remains standing till his wife is seated, and only then the two poodles can perch themselves on their chairs. He uses no terms of endearment to his family, addresses politely spiteful remarks to his wife, and bluntly tells the kids what he thinks of them. "Nicole, you're behaving quite disgracefully." The little girl is on the brink of tears, which is as it should be. This morning, the small boy was all excitement about the rats and started saying something on the subject. "Philippe, one doesn't talk of rats at table. For future, I forbid you to use the word." "Your father's right," approved the mouse. The two poodles buried their noses in their plates, and the owl acknowledged thanks by a curt, perfunctory nod. This excellent example notwithstanding, everybody in town is talking about the rats, and the local newspaper has taken a hand. The town topics column, usually very varied, is now devoted exclusively to a campaign against the local authorities. "Are our city fathers aware that the decaying bodies of these rodents constitute a grave danger to the population?" The manager of the hotel can talk of nothing else. But he has a personal grievance, too. That dead rats should be found in the elevator of a 3-star hotel seems to him the end of all things. To console him, I said, "But you know, everybody's in the same boat." "That's just it," he replied. "Now we're like everybody else." He was the first to tell me about the outbreak of this queer kind of fever which is causing much alarm. One of his chambermaids has got it. "But I feel sure it's not contagious," he hastened to assure me. I told him it was all the same to me. "Ah, I understand, sir. You're like me. You're a fatalist." I had said nothing of the kind, and what's more, I am not a fatalist. I told him so. From this point onwards, Tarou's entries deal in some detail with a curious fever that was causing much anxiety among the public. When noting that the little old man, now that the rats had ceased appearing, had regained his cats and was studiously perfecting his shooting, Tarou adds that a dozen or so cases of this fever were known to have occurred, and most had ended fatally. For a light it may throw on the narrative that follows, Tarou's description of Dr. Rieu may be suitably inserted here. So far as the narrator can judge, it is fairly accurate. Looks about 35, moderate height, broad shoulders, almost rectangular face. Dark, steady eyes, but prominent jaws. A biggish, well-modeled nose, black hair cropped very close. A curving mouth with thick, usually tight-set lips. With his tan skin, the black down on his hands and arms, the dark but becoming suits he always wears, he reminds one of a Sicilian peasant. He walks quickly. When crossing a street, he steps off the sidewalk without changing his pace. But 2 out of 3 times makes a little hop when he steps onto the sidewalk on the other side. He is absent-minded, and, when driving his car, often leaves his side signals on after he has turned a corner. Always bareheaded. Looks knowledgeable. Tarou's figures were correct. Dr. Rieu was only too well aware of the serious turn things had taken. After seeing to the isolation of the concierge's body, he had rung up Richard and asked him what he made of these inguinal fever cases. "I can make nothing of them," Richard confessed. "There have been 2 deaths, one in 48 hours, the other in 3 days, and the second patient showed all the signs of convalescence when I visited him on the second day." "Please let me know if you have other cases," Rieu said. He rang up some other colleagues. As a result of these inquiries, he gathered that there had been some 20 cases of the same type within the last few days. Almost all had ended fatally. He then advised Richard, who was chairman of the local medical association, to have any fresh cases put into isolation wards. "Sorry," Richard said, "but I can't do anything about it. An order to that effect will be issued only by the prefect. Anyhow, what grounds have you for supposing there's danger of contagion?" "No definite grounds, but the symptoms are definitely alarming." Richard, however, repeated that such measures were outside his province. The most he could do was to put the matter up to the prefect. But while these talks were going on, the weather changed for the worse. On the day following old Michel's death, the sky clouded up and there were brief torrential downpours, each of which was followed by some hours of muggy heat. The aspect of the sea, too, changed. Its dark blue translucency had gone, and under the lowering sky it had steely or silvery glints that hurt the eyes to look at. The damp heat of the spring made everyone long for the coming of the dry, clean summer heat. On the town, humped snail-wise on its plateau and shut off almost everywhere from the sea, a mood of listlessness descended. Hemmed in by lines and lines of whitewashed walls, walking between rows of dusty shops, or riding in the dingy yellow streetcars, you felt, as it were, trapped by the climate. This, however, was not the case with Rieu's old Spanish patient, who welcomed this weather with enthusiasm. "It cooks you," he said. "Just the thing for asthma." Certainly it cooked you, but exactly like a fever. Indeed, the whole town was running a temperature. Such, anyhow, was the impression Dr. Rieu could not shake off as he drove to the Rue Federbe for the inquiry into Cottard's attempted suicide. That this impression was unreasonable, he knew, and he attributed it to nervous exhaustion. He had certainly his full share of worries just at present. In fact, it was high time to put the brakes on and try to get his nerves into some sort of order. On reaching his destination, he found that the police inspector hadn't turned up yet. Grand, who met him on the landing, suggested they should wait in his place, leaving the door open. The municipal clerk had two rooms, both very sparsely furnished. The only objects to catch the eye were a bookshelf on which lay two or three dictionaries and a small blackboard on which one could just read two half-obliterated words, Flowery Avenues. Grand announced that Cottard had had a good night, but he waked up this morning with pains in his head and feeling very low. Grand, too, looked tired and overwrought. He kept pacing up and down the room, opening and closing a portfolio crammed with sheets of manuscript that lay on the table. Meanwhile, however, he informed the doctor that he really knew very little about Cottard, but believed him to have private means in a small way. Cottard was a queer bird. For a long while, their relations went no farther than wishing each other good day when they met on the stairs. "I've only had two conversations with him. Some days ago, I upset a box of colored chalks I was bringing home on the landing. They were red and blue chalks. Just then, Cottard came out of his room and he helped me pick them up. He asked me what I wanted colored chalks for." Grand had then explained to him that he was trying to brush up his Latin. He'd learned it at school, of course, but his memories had grown blurred. "You see, Doctor, I've been told that a knowledge of Latin gives one a better understanding of the real meanings of French words." So he wrote Latin words on his blackboard, then copied out again in blue chalk the part of each word that changed in conjugation or declension, and in red chalk the part of the word that never varied. "I'm not sure if Cottard followed this very clearly, but he seemed interested and asked me for a red chalk. That rather surprised me, but after all, of course, I couldn't guess the use he'd put it to." Rieu asked what was the subject of their second conversation. But just then the inspector came, accompanied by a clerk, and said he wished to begin by hearing Grand's statement. The doctor noticed that Grand, when referring to Cottard, always called him the unfortunate man, and at one moment used even the expression, his grim resolve. When discussing the possible motives for the attempted suicide, Grand showed an almost cynical anxiety over his choice of words. Finally, he elected for the expression, a secret grief. The inspector asked if there had been anything in Cottard's manner that suggested what he called his intent to felo de se. "He knocked at my door yesterday," Grand said, "and asked me for a match. I gave him a box. He said he was sorry to disturb me, but that as we were neighbors, he hoped I wouldn't mind. He assured me he'd bring back my box, but I told him to keep it." The inspector asked Grand if he'd noticed anything queer about Cottard. "What struck me as queer was that he always seemed to want to start a conversation, but he should have seen I was busy with my work." Grand turned to Rieu and added rather shyly, "Some private work." The inspector now said that he must see the invalid and hear what he had to say. Rieu thought it would be wiser to prepare Cottard for the visit. When he entered the bedroom, he found Cottard, who was wearing a gray flannel nightshirt, sitting up in bed and gazing at the door with a scared expression on his face. "It's the police, isn't it?" "Yes," Rieu said, "but don't get flustered. There are only some formalities to be gone through, and then we'll be left in peace." Cottard replied that all this was quite needless to his thinking, and anyhow, he didn't like the police. Rieu showed some irritation. I don't love them either. It's only a matter of answering a few questions as briefly and correctly as you can, and then you'll be through with it. Cottard said nothing, and Rieux began to move to the door. He'd hardly taken a step when the little man called him back, and as soon as he was at the bedside, gripped his hands. They can't be rough with an invalid, a man who's hanged himself, can they, doctor? Rieux gazed down at him for a moment, then assured him that there was no question of anything like that, and in any case, he was here to protect his patient. This seemed to relieve Cottard, and Rieux went out to get the inspector. After Grand's deposition had been read out, Cottard was asked to state the exact motive of his act. He merely replied, without looking at the police officer, that a secret grief described it well enough. The inspector then asked him peremptorily if he intended to have another go at it. Showing more animation, Cottard said certainly not. His one wish was to be left in peace. "Allow me to point out, my man," the police inspector rejoined with asperity, "that just now it's you who are troubling the peace of others." Rieux signed to him not to continue, and he left it at that. "A good hour wasted," the inspector sighed when the door closed behind them. "As you can guess, we've other things to think about, what with this fever everybody's talking of." He then asked the doctor if there was any serious danger to the town. Rieux answered that he couldn't say. "It must be the weather," the police officer decided. "That's what it is." No doubt it was the weather. As the day wore on, everything grew sticky to the touch, and Rieux felt his anxiety increasing after each visit. That evening, a neighbor of his old patient in the suburb started vomiting, pressing his hands to his groin, and running a high fever accompanied by delirium. The ganglia were much bigger than Monsieur Michel's. One of them was beginning to suppurate, and presently split open like an overripe fruit. On returning to his apartment, Rieux rang up the medical store's depot for the district. In his professional diary for the day, the only entry was negative reply. Already he was receiving calls for similar cases from various parts of the town. Obviously, the abscesses had to be lanced. Two crisscross strokes, and the ganglion disgorged a mixture of blood and pus. Their limbs stretched as far as they could manage, the sick men went on bleeding. Dark patches appeared on their legs and stomachs. Sometimes a ganglion would stop suppurating, then suddenly swell again. Usually the sick man died in a stench of corruption. The local press, so lavish of news about the rats, now had nothing to say. For rats died in the street, men in their homes, and newspapers are concerned only with the street. Meanwhile, government and municipal officials were putting their heads together. So long as each individual doctor had come across only two or three cases, no one had thought of taking action. But it was merely a matter of adding up the figures, and once this had been done, the total was startling. In a very few days, the number of cases had risen by leaps and bounds, and it became evident to all observers of this strange malady that a real epidemic had set in. This was the state of affairs when Castel, one of Rieux's colleagues and a much older man than he, came to see him. "Naturally," he said to Rieux, "you know what it is." "I am waiting for the result of the postmortems." "Well, I know, and I don't need any postmortems. I was in China for a good part of my career, and I saw some cases in Paris 20 years ago. Only no one dared to call them by their name on that occasion. The usual taboo, of course. The public mustn't be alarmed, that wouldn't do at all. And then, as one of my colleagues said, it's unthinkable. Everyone knows it ceased to appear in Western Europe." "Yes, everyone knew that, except the dead men. Come now, Rieux. You know as well as I do what it is." Rieux pondered. He was looking out the window of his surgery at the tall cliff that closed the half-circle of the bay on the far horizon. Though blue, the sky had a dull sheen that was softening as the light declined. "Yes, Castel," he replied, "it's hardly credible, but everything points to its being plague." Castel got up and began walking toward the door. "You know," the old doctor said, "what they're going to tell us? That it vanished from temperate countries long ago." "Vanished? What does that word really mean?" Rieux shrugged his shoulders. "Yes, and don't forget, just under 20 years ago in Paris, too." "Right. Let's hope it won't prove any worse this time than it did then. But really, it's incredible." The word plague had just been uttered for the first time. At this stage of the narrative, with Dr. Bernard Rieu standing at his window, the narrator may perhaps be allowed to justify the doctor's uncertainty and surprise, since, with very slight differences, his reaction was the same as that of the great majority of our townsfolk. Everybody knows that pestilences have a way of recurring in the world, yet somehow we find it hard to believe in ones that crash down on our heads from a blue sky. There have been as many plagues as wars in history, yet always plagues and wars take people equally by surprise. In fact, like our fellow citizens, Rieu was caught off his guard, and we should understand his hesitations in the light of this fact, and similarly understand how he was torn between conflicting fears and confidence. When a war breaks out, people say, "It's too stupid, it can't last long." But though war may well be too stupid, that doesn't prevent its lasting. Stupidity has a knack of getting its way, as we should see if we were not always so much wrapped up in ourselves. In this respect, our townsfolk were like everybody else, wrapped up in themselves. In other words, they were humanists. They disbelieved in pestilences. A pestilence isn't a thing made to man's measure. Therefore, we tell ourselves that pestilence is a mere bogey of the mind, a bad dream that will pass away. But it doesn't always pass away. And from one bad dream to another, it is men who pass away, and the humanists first of all, because they haven't taken their precautions. Our townsfolk were not more to blame than others. They forgot to be modest, that was all, and thought that everything still was possible for them, which presupposed that pestilences were impossible. They went on doing business, arranged for journeys, and formed views. How should they have given a thought to anything like plague, which rules out any future, cancels journeys, silences the exchange of views? They fancied themselves free, and no one will ever be free so long as there are pestilences. Indeed, even after Dr. Rieu had admitted in his friend's company that a handful of persons scattered about the town had, without warning, died of plague, the danger still remained fantastically unreal. For the simple reason that when a man is a doctor, he comes to have his own ideas of physical suffering and to acquire somewhat more imagination than the average. Looking from his window at the town, outwardly quite unchanged, the doctor felt little more than a faint qualm for the future, a vague unease. He tried to recall what he had read about the disease. Figures floated across his memory, and he recalled that some 30 or so great plagues known to history had accounted for nearly 100 million deaths. But what are 100 million deaths? When one has served in a war, one hardly knows what a dead man is after a while. And since a dead man has no substance, unless one has actually seen him dead, 100 million corpses broadcast through history are no more than a puff of smoke in the imagination. The doctor remembered the plague at Constantinople, that, according to Procopius, caused 10,000 deaths in a single day. 10,000 dead made about 5 times the audience in a biggish cinema. Yes, that was how it should be done. You should collect the people at the exits of 5 picture houses. You should lead them to a city square and make them die in heaps if you wanted to get a clear notion of what it means. Then at least you could add some familiar faces to the anonymous mass. But naturally that was impossible to put into practice. Moreover, what man knows 10,000 faces? In any case, the figures of those old historians like Procopius weren't to be relied on. That was common knowledge. 70 years ago, at Canton, 40,000 rats died of plague before the disease spread to the inhabitants. But again, in the Canton epidemic, there was no reliable way of counting up the rats. A very rough estimate was all that could be made, with obviously a wide margin for error. Let's see, the doctor murmured to himself, supposing the length of the rat to be 10 inches, 40,000 rats placed end to end would make a line of... He pulled himself up sharply. He was letting his imagination play pranks, the last thing he wanted just now. A few cases, he told himself, don't make an epidemic. They merely call for serious precautions. He must fix his mind first of all on the observed facts. Stupor and extreme prostration, buboes, intense thirst, delirium, dark blotches on the body, internal dilatation, and in conclusion, some words came back to the doctor's mind. Aptly enough, the concluding sentence of the description of the symptoms given in his medical handbook. The pulse becomes fluttering, dichrotic, and intermittent, and death ensues as the result of the slightest movement. Yes, in conclusion, the patient's life hung on a thread. And three people out of four, he remembered the exact figures, were too impatient not to make the very slight movement that snapped the thread. The doctor was still looking out of the window. Beyond it lay the tranquil radiance of a cool spring sky. Inside the room, a word was echoing still. The word, plague. A word that conjured up in the doctor's mind not only what science chose to put into it, but a whole series of fantastic possibilities utterly out of keeping with that gray and yellow town under his eyes, from which were rising the sounds of mild activity characteristic of the hour. A drone rather than a bustling. The noises of a happy town, in short, if it's possible to be at once so dull and happy. A tranquility so casual and thoughtless seemed almost effortlessly to give the lie to those old pictures of the plague. Athens, a charnel house weakened to heaven and deserted even by the birds. Chinese towns cluttered up with victims silent in their agony. The convicts at Marseille piling rotting corpses into pits. The building of the Great Wall in Provence to fend off the furious plague wind. The damp, putrefying pallets stuck to the mud floor at the Constantinople laser house, where the patients were hauled up from their beds with hooks. The carnival of masked doctors at the Black Death. Men and women copulating in the cemeteries of Milan. Cartloads of dead bodies rumbling through London's ghoul-haunted darkness. Nights and days filled always everywhere with the eternal cry of human pain. No, all those horrors were not near enough as yet, even to ruffle the equanimity of that spring afternoon. The clang of an unseen streetcar came through the window, briskly refuting cruelty and pain. Only the sea, murmurous behind the dingy checkerboard of houses, told of the unrest, the precariousness of all things in this world. And gazing in the direction of the bay, Dr. Rieu called to mind the plague fires, of which Lucretius tells, which the Athenians kindled on the seashore. The dead were brought there after nightfall, but there was not room enough, and the living fought one another with torches for a space where to lay those who had been dear to them, for they had rather engage in bloody conflicts than abandon their dead to the waves. A picture rose before him of the red glow of the pyres mirrored on a wine-dark, slumberous sea, battling torches, whirling sparks across the darkness, and thick, fetid smoke rising towards the watchful sky. Yes, it was not beyond the bounds of possibility. But these extravagant forebodings dwindled in the light of reason. True, the word plague had been uttered. True, at this very moment, one or two victims were being seized and laid low by the disease. Still, that could stop, or be stopped. It was only a matter of lucidly recognizing what had to be recognized, of dispelling extraneous shadows and doing what needed to be done. Then the plague would come to an end, because it was unthinkable, or rather because one thought of it on misleading lines. If, as was most likely, it died out, all would be well. If not, one would know it anyhow for what it was, and what steps should be taken for coping with it and finally overcoming it. The doctor opened the window, and at once the noises of the town grew louder. The brief, intermittent sibilance of a machine saw came from a nearby workshop. Rieu pulled himself together. There lay certitude, there in the daily round. All the rest hung on mere threads and trivial contingencies. You couldn't waste your time on it. The thing was to do your job as it should be done. The doctor's musings had reached this point when the visit of Joseph Grand was announced. Grand's duties as clerk in the municipal office were varied, and he was sometimes employed in the statistical department on compiling the figures of births, marriages, and deaths. Thus it had fallen to him to add up the number of deaths during the last few days. And, being of an obliging disposition, he had volunteered to bring a copy of the latest figures to the doctor. Grand, who was waving a sheet of paper, was accompanied by his neighbor, Cottard. "The figures are going up, doctor. 11 deaths in 48 hours. Rieu shook hands with Cottard and asked him how he was feeling. Grand put in a word explaining that Cottard was bent on thanking the doctor and apologizing for the trouble he had given. But Rieu was gazing frowningly at the figures on the sheet of paper. "Well," he said, "perhaps we'd better make up our minds to call this disease by its name. So far, we've only been shilly-shallying. Look here, I'm off to the laboratory. Like to come with me?" Quite so," Grand said as he went down the stairs at the doctor's heels. "I, too, believe in calling things by their name. But what's the name in this case?" That I shan't say. And anyhow, you wouldn't gain anything by knowing. You see, Gore smiled, it's not so easy after all. They started off toward the Place d'Armes. Cottard still kept silent. The streets were beginning to fill up. The brief dusk of our town was already giving place to night, and the first stars glimmered above the still clearly marked horizon. A few moments later, all the street lamps went on, dimming the sky, and the voices in the street seemed to rise a tone. "Excuse me," Gore said at the corner of the Place d'Armes, "but I must catch my car now. My evenings are sacred, as we say in my part of the world. Never put off to tomorrow." Rieu had already noticed Gore's trick of professing to quote some turn of speech from his part of the world. He hailed from Montélimar, and following up with some such hackneyed expression as lost in dreams or pretty as a picture. "That's so," Cottard put in. "You can never budge him from his den after dinner." Rieu asked Gore if he was doing extra work for the municipality. Gore said no, he was working on his own account. "Really," Rieu said, to keep the conversation going, "are you getting on well with it?" "Considering I've been at it for years, it would be surprising if I wasn't, though in one sense there hasn't been much progress. May one know," the doctor halted, "what it is that you're engaged on?" Gore put a hand up to his hat and tugged it down upon his big protruding ears, then murmured some half-inaudible remark from which Rieu seemed to gather that Gore's work was connected with the growth of a personality. Then he turned rather hastily, and a moment later was hurrying with short, quick steps under the fig trees lining the Boulevard de la Marne. When they were at the laboratory gate, Cottard told the doctor that he would greatly like to see him and ask his advice about something. Rieu, who was fingering in his pocket the sheet of paper with the figures on it, said he'd better call during his consulting hours. Then, changing his mind, told him he would be in his part of the town next day and would drop in to see him at the end of the afternoon. On leaving Cottard, the doctor noticed that he was thinking of Grand, trying to picture him in the midst of an outbreak of plague. Not an outbreak like the present one, which would probably not prove serious, but like one of the great visitations of the past. He's the kind of man who always escapes in such cases. Rieu remembered having read somewhere that the plague spared weak constitutions and chose its victims chiefly among the robust. Still thinking of Grand, he decided that he was something of a mystery man in his small way. True, at first sight, Grand manifested both the outward signs and typical manner of a humble employee in the local administration. Tall and thin, he seemed lost in the garments that he always chose a size too large, under the illusion that they would wear longer. Though he still had most of the teeth in his lower jaw, all the upper ones were gone, with the result that when he smiled, raising his upper lip, the lower scarcely moved, his mouth looked like a small black hole let into his face. Also, he had the walk of a shy young priest, sidling along walls and slipping mouse-like into doorways, and he exuded a faint odor of smoke in basement rooms. In short, he had all the attributes of insignificance. Indeed, it cost an effort to picture him otherwise than bent over a desk, studiously revising the tariff of the town baths, or gathering for a junior secretary the materials of a report on the new garbage collection tax. Even before you knew what his employment was, you had a feeling that he'd been brought into the world for the sole purpose of performing the discreet but needful duties of a temporary assistant municipal clerk on a salary of 62 francs 30 centimes a day. This was, in fact, the entry that he made each month in the staff register at the municipal office in the column Post in which employed. When, 22 years previously, after obtaining a matriculation certificate beyond which for lack of money he was unable to progress, he was given this temporary post, he'd been led to expect, or so he said, speedy confirmation in it. It was only a matter of proving his ability to cope with the delicate problems raised by the administration of our city. Once confirmed, they had assured him, he couldn't fail to be promoted to a grade that would enable him to live quite comfortably. Ambition certainly was not the spur that activated Joseph Grand. That he would swear to, wryly smiling. All he desired was the prospect of a life suitably insured on the material side by honest work, enabling him to devote his leisure to his hobbies. If he'd accepted the post offered him, it was from honorable motives and, if he might say so, loyalty to an ideal. But this temporary state of things had gone on and on. The cost of living rose by leaps and bounds, and Grand's pay, in spite of some statutory rises, was still a mere pittance. He had confided this to Rieu, but nobody else seemed aware of his position. And here lies Grand's originality, or anyway, an indication of it. He could certainly have brought to official notice, if not his rights, of which he wasn't sure, at least the promises given him. But, for one thing, the departmental head who had made them had been dead for some time, and, furthermore, Grand no longer remembered their exact terms. And lastly, this was the real trouble, Joseph Grand couldn't find his words. This peculiarity, as Rieu had noticed, was really the key to the personality of our worthy fellow citizen. And this it was which always prevented him from writing the mildly protesting letter he had in mind, or taking the steps the situation called for. According to him, he felt a particular aversion from talking about his rights. The word was one that gave him pause. And likewise from mentioning a promise, which would have implied that he was claiming his due, and thus bespoken an audacity incompatible with the humble post he filled. On the other hand, he refused to use expressions such as your kindness, gratitude, or even solicit, which, to his thinking, were incompatible with his personal dignity. Thus, owing to his inability to find the right words, he had gone on performing his obscure, ill-paid duties until a somewhat advanced age. Also, this anyhow was what he told Dr. Rieu, he had come, after long experience, to realize that he could always count on living within his means. All he had to do was scale down his needs to his income. Thus he confirmed the wisdom of an opinion often voiced by our mayor, a business magnate of the town, when he insisted vehemently that in the last analysis, he emphasized this choice expression, which indeed clinched his argument, there was no reason to believe that anyone had ever died of hunger in the town. In any case, the austere, not to say ascetic life of Joseph Grand was, in the last analysis, a guarantee against any anxiety in this respect. He went on looking for his words. In a certain sense, it might well be said that his was an exemplary life. He was one of those rare people, rare in our town as elsewhere, who have the courage of their good feelings. What little he told of his personal life vouched for acts of kindness and a capacity for affection that no one in our times dares own to. Without a blush, he confessed to dearly loving his nephews and sister, his only surviving near relation, whom he went to France to visit every other year. He admitted that the thought of his parents, whom he lost when he was very young, often gave him a pang. He did not conceal the fact that he had a special affection for a church bell in his part of the town, which started pealing very melodiously at about 5 every afternoon. Yet to express such emotions, simple as they were, the least word cost him a terrible effort. And this difficulty in finding his words had come to be the bane of his life. "Oh, doctor," he would exclaim, "how I'd like to learn to express myself." He brought the subject up each time he met Rieu. That evening, as he watched Grand's receding form, it flashed on the doctor what it was that Grand was trying to convey. He was evidently writing a book, or something of the sort. And quaintly enough, as he made his way to the laboratory, this thought reassured him. He realized how absurd it was, but he simply couldn't believe that a pestilence on the great scale could befall a town where people like Grand were to be found, obscure functionaries cultivating harmless eccentricities. To be precise, he couldn't picture such eccentricities existing in a plague-stricken community, and he concluded that the chances were all against the plagues making any headway among our fellow citizens. Next day, by dint of a persistence that many thought ill-advised, Rieu persuaded the authorities to convene a health committee at the prefect's office. "People in town are getting nervous, that's a fact," Dr. Richard admitted, "and of course all sorts of wild rumors are going around. The prefect said to me, take prompt action if you like, but don't attract attention. He personally is convinced that it's a false alarm." Rieu gave Castel a lift to the prefect's office. "Do you know," Castel said when they were in the car, "that we haven't a gram of serum in the whole district?" "I know. I rang up the depot. The director seemed quite startled. It'll have to be sent from Paris. And let's hope they're quick about it." "I sent a wire yesterday," Rieu said. The prefect greeted them amiably enough, but one could see his nerves were on edge. "Let's make a start, gentlemen," he said. "Need I review the situation?" Richard thought that wasn't necessary. He and his colleagues were acquainted with the facts. The only question was what measures should be adopted. "The question," old Castel cut in almost rudely, "is to know whether it's plague or not." Two or three of the doctors present protested. The others seemed to hesitate. The prefect gave a start and hurriedly glanced toward the door to make sure it had prevented this outrageous remark from being overheard in the corridor. Richard said that in his opinion, the great thing was not to take an alarmist view. All that could be said at present was that we had to deal with a special type of fever with inguinal complications. In medical science, as in daily life, it was unwise to jump to conclusions. Old Castel, who was placidly chewing his draggled yellow moustache, raised his pale bright eyes and gazed at Rieu. Then, after sweeping the other members of the committee with a friendly glance, he said that he knew quite well that it was the plague. And needless to say, he also knew that, were this to be officially admitted, the authorities would be compelled to take very drastic steps. This was, of course, the explanation of his colleagues' reluctance to face the facts. And, if it would ease their minds, he was quite prepared to say it wasn't plague. The prefect seemed ruffled and remarked that in any case this line of argument seemed to him unsound. The important thing, Castel replied, isn't the soundness or otherwise of the argument, but for it to make you think. Rieu, who had said nothing so far, was asked for his opinion. We're dealing, he said, with a fever of a typhoidal nature accompanied by vomiting and buboes. I have incised these buboes and had the pus analyzed. Our laboratory analyst believes he has identified the plague bacillus, but I'm bound to add that there are specific modifications that don't quite tally with the classical description of the plague bacillus. Richard pointed out that this justified a policy of wait and see. Anyhow, it would be wise to await the statistical report on the series of analyses that had been going on for several days. When a microbe, Rieu said, after a short intermission can quadruple in 3 days' time the volume of the spleen, can swell the mesenteric ganglia to the size of an orange and give them the consistency of gruel, a policy of wait and see is, to say the least of it, unwise. The foci of infection are steadily extending. Judging by the rapidity with which the disease is spreading, it may well, unless we can stop it, kill off half the town before 2 months are out. That being so, it has small importance whether you call it plague or some rare kind of fever. The important thing is to prevent its killing off half the population of this town. Richard said it was a mistake to paint too gloomy a picture, and moreover, the disease hadn't proved to be contagious. Indeed, relatives of his patients living under the same roof had escaped it. But others have died, Rieu observed. And obviously, contagion is never absolute. Otherwise, you'd have a constant mathematical progression, and the death rate would rocket up catastrophically. It's not a question of painting too black a picture. It's a question of taking precautions. Richard, however, summing up the situation as he saw it, pointed out that if the epidemic did not cease spontaneously, it would be necessary to apply the rigorous prophylactic measures laid down in the code. And to do this, it would be necessary to admit officially that plague had broken out. But of this, there was no absolute certainty. Therefore, any hasty action was to be deprecated. Rieu stuck to his guns. The point isn't whether the measures provided for in the code are rigorous, but whether they are needful to prevent the death of half the population. All the rest is a matter of administrative action. And I needn't remind you that our Constitution has provided for such emergencies by empowering prefects to issue the necessary orders. Quite true, the prefect assented, but I shall need your professional declaration that the epidemic is one of plague. If we don't make that declaration, Rieu said, there's a risk that half the population may be wiped out. Richard cut in with some impatience. The truth is that our colleague is convinced it's plague. His description of the syndrome proved it. Rieu replied that he had not described a syndrome, but merely what he'd seen with his own eyes. And what he'd seen was buboes and high fever accompanied by delirium, ending fatally within 48 hours. Could Dr. Richard take the responsibility of declaring that the epidemic would die out without the imposition of rigorous prophylactic measures? Richard hesitated, then fixed his eyes on Rieu. Please answer me quite frankly. Are you absolutely convinced it's plague? You are stating the problem wrongly. It's not a question of the term I use. It's a question of time. Your view, I take it, the prefect put in, is this. Even if it isn't plague, the prophylactic measures enjoined by law for coping with a state of plague should be put into force immediately. Well, if you insist on my having a view, that conveys it accurately enough. The doctors confabulated. Richard was their spokesman. It comes to this. We are to take the responsibility of acting as though the epidemic were plague. This way of putting it met with general approval. It doesn't matter to me, Rieu said, how you phrase it. My point is that we should not act as if there were no likelihood that half the population would be wiped out, for then it would be. Followed by scowls and protestations, Rieu left the committee room. Some minutes later, as he was driving down a back street redolent of fried fish and urine, a woman screaming in agony, her groin dripping blood, stretched out her arms toward him. On the day after the committee meeting, the fever notched another small advance. It even found its way into the papers, but discreetly. Only a few brief references to it were made. On the following day, however, Rieu observed that small official notices had been just put up about the town, though in places where they would not attract much attention. It was hard to find in these notices any indication that the authorities were facing the situation squarely. The measures enjoined were far from draconian, and one had the feeling that many concessions had been made to a desire not to alarm the public. The instructions began with a bald statement that a few cases of a malignant fever had been reported in Oran. It was not possible as yet to say if this fever was contagious. The symptoms were not so marked as to be really perturbing, and the authorities felt sure they could rely on the townspeople to treat the situation with composure. Nonetheless, guided by a spirit of prudence that all would appreciate, the prefect was putting into force some precautionary measures. If these measures were carefully studied and properly applied, they would obviate any risk of an epidemic. This being so, the prefect felt no doubt that everybody in his jurisdiction would wholeheartedly second his personal efforts. The notice outlined the general program that the authorities had drawn up. It included a systematic extermination of the rat population by injecting poison gas into the sewers and a strict supervision of the water supply. The townspeople were advised to practice extreme cleanliness, and any who found fleas on their persons were directed to call at the municipal dispensaries. Also, heads of households were ordered promptly to report any fever case diagnosed by their doctors and to permit the isolation of sick members of their families in special wards at the hospital. These wards, it was explained, were equipped to provide patients with immediate treatment and ensure the maximum prospect of recovery. Some supplementary regulations enjoined compulsory disinfection of the sick room and of the vehicle in which the patient traveled. For the rest, the prefect confined himself to advising all who had been in contact with the patient to consult the sanitary inspector and strictly to follow his advice.